This episode, our own Paul Fagan catches up with Carl Gershman, who heads up the National Endowment for Democracy. And while Carl doesn't pull any punches about the threat we're seeing under COVID of authoritarianism, I think you'll be very interested to hear about some hopeful, even inspirational points of democracy around the world that can inspire even better democracy right here at home.
This is Luke Koenig, and you're in the arena with leaders and citizens who take character-based action. In the Arena is a proud member of the Democracy Group podcast network. For more information, visit democracygroup.org.
Today we're joined with Carl Gershman, the president of the National Endowment for Democracy. Excuse me. My name is Paul Fagan. I'm with the McCain Institute. I am the Human Rights and Democracy Director. Carl, thanks so much for joining us today and today's In the Arena podcast.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Paul.
Yeah. Now this is a great day to have someone like you talking to us. I know we have some questions that I wanted to ask you, but I wanted to start off just kind of asking about a recent event. In early August, you and several other heads of democracy and human rights organizations, you know, have been threatened or have been sanctioned by the Chinese government. It's a pretty startling event for an individual like yourself to be sanctioned by a government. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why this is happening?
Well, you know, it doesn't really, right now, it hasn't affected me personally. The way the people in Hong Kong have been affected, because it was related to the crackdown. It was related to the U.S. sanctioning various officials in China over a number of things that China is doing. It obviously did highlight the fact that, you know, what's happened to the relationship. We could worry that they may be hacking us at some point or trying to crack into our internet. But overall, you know, it doesn't affect us. I wasn't going to China anyway. It's not been a serious thing. But, you know, I think people are realizing now, and it's totally bipartisan, that China really represents a very severe threat. And, you know, whenever, I know everybody, we have to deal with China. It's got a large economy. It's an influential country. But, you know, you cannot deal with them without recognizing, as you're dealing with them, that they are committing genocide against the people of East Turkestan or Xinjiang, whatever you want to call it, but the Uyghur people and Muslim people more generally in that region. And they've also violated all their promises in Hong Kong and are now, you know, really crushing what had been a rule of law democratic society in Hong Kong. They're behaving extremely aggressively in other places, especially in the South China Sea. Yeah. We have a real problem with China. We don't really know where it's going. Mm-hmm. A lot of specialists think that it has a lot of very serious internal problems and does a lot of this in order to whip up nationalism and make the regime appear strong. But it's a very, very dangerous problem. And that's really what the issue is, not the fact that they sanctions, you know, NED or NDI.
Yeah. Well, it's a testament to the work that, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy has been doing for 40 years in China and so many other places around the world. You've seen massive trend, you know, in the past 40 years, seen massive transformations. You know, seen the fall of the Berlin Wall, many autocrats, military dictatorships have fallen. You know, we really saw a trend towards democracy for a long time. But, you know, according to like places like Freedom House, who do a lot of the trending, you know, documentation, they're seeing reverses in democracy. They're seeing, you know, countries going in the wrong direction. Do you agree with that? Or do you see that democracy is strengthening and getting stronger?
There's no doubt that democracy is in crisis. And we've talked about that for a long time. Larry Diamond has used the word recession to describe what's happened. To be perfectly frank, it shouldn't be surprising to us. You know, when Sam Huntington wrote his famous book about the third wave of democratization. The book, you know, talked about earlier waves of democratization, the first wave that included our own country and Western Europe, the second wave after World War II, and each one of them was followed by a reverse wave. And even wrote about the reverse wave in the third wave. And he talked about the fact that it would be very, very difficult to for democracy to continue to expand because it was coming up against problems, you know, in East Asia, in the Islamic world, and so forth. He was very skeptical about the continued expansion. And obviously, it's when democracy expands to the degree that it did, it's very difficult to absorb those changes and for these transitions to succeed. And so a lot of them haven't succeeded. There have been very, you know, serious backsliding, problems of corruption. And in a way, that shouldn't surprise us. The NED produced the strategy paper in January. And trying to describe the current period that we're in, we said that the dominant feature of this current period is a tension that exists between the recession of democracy, but also its resilience. And that's something that we shouldn't overlook. When this paper was done, you know, we had seen protests, and it was before COVID, and we had seen protests in many places, including in Hong Kong, in Russia, in many, many other countries. You had this remarkable transformation in Sudan in 2019, which nobody expected, but it was really a popular movement that led to that. And you had other places that were changing. Some of them, you know, have not worked out as well as we had hoped, like in Ethiopia is going through a crisis today, or Malaysia, which had a change in 2018. But Armenia is still moving forward. And it happened in a lot of places. And now, you know, the uprising in Belarus is really the most important thing that's happening today. They may be able to reverse it, but it's different from Hong Kong, because Belarus is an independent country, and it really is a country transformed, reborn. And we'll see where it goes, but there, it's not all going one way or the other, and I think that's important. And so then the question becomes, if there is this resilience, how do you encourage it? How do you support it? How do you show solidarity with the people that are in these movements? And that's really what we have to think about today.
And that brings me to my next question, a little bit about the history of NED, a little, you know, background 101, if I may. You know, it has been around for almost 40 years. You know, can you just tell us a little bit about NED's uniqueness? You know, its bipartisan support, its evolution, how did it come about? In just a few minutes, because I know you could probably, you know, go
I could talk a long time about it, of course. But, you know, first of all, it was at the beginning of the Reagan administration after Vietnam, and he was, and the Reagan administration was looking to re-engage with the world. There had also been Democrats like Dante Fassel in the Congress that had tried to create something like NED before. And when Reagan came along, they saw it as an opportunity. Also, the labor movement that had international programs dealing with Asia, Africa, and Latin America. But Solidarity had emerged in 1980, and they had no mechanisms for aiding Solidarity in Europe. So they wanted something new. So there was a lot of interest in this. And then you had the very important transitions that took place in Spain and Portugal. After the military fell in Portugal in 1974, Franco died in 1975. And the German political foundations went into Spain and Portugal and really helped with two successful transitions that were not expected by the U.S. administrations. And I can remember when someone called me saying, we really need something like that. Look, and we didn't have it at the time. After Vietnam, the U.S. pretty much withdrew. And then the question was, well, how do we re-engage? And we had, you know, military capacity, trade capacity, diplomatic capacity, but we had no political capacity. And so a kind of bipartisan consensus came together. George Agri created something called the American Political Foundation, which brought the two parties into it. There was some idea of trying to replicate in some way the German model. And then after Reagan gave his famous Westminster address, where he called for a global campaign for democracy, it then was left to the Congress to put together a bill, which they did, the National Endowment for Democracy Act, and Reagan signed it into law in December of 83, which was about almost a year and a half after he had given that speech. And it wasn't just the bipartisanship that was unique. It was also a private institution. They really emphasized that it had to be independent. It couldn't be tied to the government. If you were going to pursue this work of democracy's support consistently over time, it had to be divorced from immediate diplomatic priorities mm-hmm. and objectives, which were constraints, and it would also undermine your ability yeah. to support people on the ground, because the key to the success of the NED really yeah. is that we don't impose a U.S. agenda on right. people fighting for democracy around the world. We try to empower them to achieve yeah. their objectives. And that's a very hard thing to understand. But without the independence that the NED Act gave us, which really authorized the funding of NED, but also stipulated that the executive branch could not, had no veto over what mm-hmm. we did. You know, we had to abide by certain regulations in terms of the use of the funds, but the direction, the programmatic choices that we made were all independent and were governed by an independent board. And that's quite remarkable. Of course, we have these four institutes as well,
right?
The Democratic and Republican Party institutes. The AFL-CIO was the major institution involved when the NED was created, mm-hmm. The only one that had a pre-existing program on the ground. And then they brought in the business, the Chamber of Commerce, to balance labor.
Right.
So it has that kind of balance, political balance and institutional yeah. balance, which also provide a kind of surrogate for being a public institution. In other right. words, we have large national institutions at the core of the NED, but it's also private. And right. and I think the model has been accepted. We had a very perilous beginning. There were, you know, it was a new idea. There were a lot of people that right. thought it was a reckless and dangerous idea. But over time, we were able to build support. You know, you talked about all the changes, and obviously the end of the Cold War was a big change. And then the 90s were a difficult period because mm-hmm. Charles Krauthammer called it a vacation from history. A lot of people felt we didn't have any need for this anymore yeah. because the world was perfect.
Right.
All the problems were solved. And, you know, then you had 9/11. And since 9/11, it's been really the NED has just continued to grow.
Right, right. No, it's, you know, I want to draw you out on the bipartisanship a little bit. You know, from the McCain Institute, Senator McCain, this is a big legacy issue for him, supporting human rights activists, democracies around the world. You know, I worked at IRI for a long time where he was the chairman. And on the other side, you know, you still have Secretary Madeleine Albright, you know, representing NDI. Can you just talk about Senator McCain a little bit and his influence on NED, but this type of work, and how, you know, his influence, you know, helped or, you know, in Congress on this issue?
Well, you know, McCain, among some Republicans, when he joined the Congress, he was not convinced that this was a great idea. But, you know, we were on an observer delegation together, and I had just come starting NED working for Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick, and it was yeah. love at first sight after that point. And so in the mid-80s, with Lorne yeah. Craner as his staff, he became yeah. a core supporter of NED.
Yeah.
And his support only grew. You know, I mean, McCain was a great, great patriot. And in the book that he wrote, you know, before he passed away, The Restless Wave, I mean, there was never been a more powerful expression of commitment to the core values of our country.
Yeah.
And he was trying to restore that. We have to return to those values, because he was very worried that for many, many reasons, we were losing any connection
yeah.
with those values. And, you know, with all the divisions in the country, the increasing polarization, mm-hmm. Social media dividing people up into echo chambers, the globalization, which was leaving behind a lot of different people.
Yeah.
We were losing a sense of what this country stood for.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I admired most about him was the way his commitment to these values grew stronger and mm-hmm. stronger and stronger, especially, you know, as he approached the end of his life.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the great memories I have is that it was in September of 2017, we were organizing an event at NED with Vladimir Karamurza,
yeah.
who had made a film, a documentary about his mentor, Boris Nemtsov.
Yeah.
And Vladimir invited McCain to come to the meeting. McCain might not have come if I had invited him, but because Vladimir invited
yeah.
McCain.
Yeah.
And this was in September of 17, and McCain had already been diagnosed with incurable cancer. And he came, and we had the most wonderful meeting. You know, we showed the film, McCain gave an introductory remark, and then we had a discussion afterwards. And, you know, he was idolized by people in countries that were at the forefront of the struggle because of his, you know, deep and profound commitment. And it only grew stronger. And in that book, The Restless Wave, you know, he talked about the critical thing is U.S. values. And they were U.S. American values that he was talking about. And what were they? They were just simple, liberal principles of separation of power, of the rule of law, of having a free media, free elections, constitutionalism, a system where it's not defined by a winner. A winner takes all, but where there's compromise and there's tolerance. And he spoke with the deepest passion about these things. And I just think he uplifted people all over the world. So yes, it was great that he was the chairman of IRI for 25 years. But much, much more than that, he became a force to be reckoned with and a voice to be reckoned with all over the world. I mean, I think they've named a street after him in Kiev and Ukraine. But everywhere, people looked at him. And it wasn't just in the post-communist countries. It was everywhere that he was an ally. He was a friend of freedom. And said that our greatest obligation was to be in solidarity with the imprisoned in this world and the people who are suffering. We have to come back to that. We can come back to that. We have not yet come back to that, but we have to. And he even mentioned, I remember we had a banner up when I was sitting with him during that event with Vladimir Karamurza. He looked up at the banner and he said, you know, it was a great idea of Reagan to create something like this. Because this, in a way, is the embodiment of this bipartisan commitment in the United States to these values. It's still there. But it's now being overwhelmed by the divisiveness, the cynicism, the polarization, the social media, the interference from foreign countries. But it's still there. And we have to find a way to recover it. And maybe remembering Senator McCain and what he stood for will help us.
We're still, you know, we miss him. We all miss him. And he obviously is the inspiration for the Institute and carrying on his work. So thank you for those really kind words, but they still ring true. You know, I was just looking at, you know, a tweet from a woman, you know, from Belarus saying, you know, he would be in Minsk today. He would be, or if he wasn't allowed in Minsk, he would be, you know, at the border in Lithuania, he would be marching with them. So it's a good reminder that he's still remembered and he still matters to so many people around the world for all of the efforts that they've made, because he lent them support and a voice. Speaking of supporting democracy, you and, you know, hundreds of other organizations have come together for something called, you know, Defend Democracy. And I think there's going to be a big push around September 15th, which is the International Day of Democracy. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, why it's needed and why there's a push for this? You sort of alluded to it, but why is there a push for Defend Democracy?
Well, it's a call to defend democracy. And it's an appeal really to the world. And what happened, of course, was that once COVID-19 started and the lockdown started, a lot of dictators around the world, authoritarian countries started tightening their controls, but also other countries that were not as closed started passing laws that were strengthening central government power and also restricting individual liberties. And so there was a crisis of democracy, and it was necessary to defend democracy. And why is democracy relevant? And the call, you know, gives a number of different reasons as to, you know, why democracy is important in addressing a problem like COVID or other problems, you know, where you have accountability. I mean, the COVID started in Wuhan in China because they basically silenced people who were trying to say, we have a problem. Responsible citizens, Li Wenliang and seven others were silenced. And you know, there was a study done saying that if they had begun to crack down on that disease 3 weeks earlier, it might have reduced the death toll in the world by 95%, but they just let it spread until it just got out of control and became a pandemic. And so you need the openness, the accountability, the active civil society and responsible citizens in order to deal with problems like this. But as we say in the call, it's not enough. I mean, as we know from our own country, here we are a democracy in the United States, and we haven't handled this very well. So democracy is not sufficient. You need also good governance. You need governance that relies upon data and knowledge that is, you know, that is scientific and that is something that we know. It doesn't give you the answer to all problems, but you have to proceed with a plan based in a responsible way, and you need democratic governments to do that. Now, there have been many democratic governments that have done rather well in trying to contend, you know, with this, Taiwan being one. South Korea has done well, you know, Germany and and other democracies have done very well and probably are among the best. Yeah. China's trying to make the case that you need a strong central government to lock down everything and to control everything. And so right now there is a battle of narratives underway in the world. And we have to make, you know, and they're trying to make the case, the authoritarians, that democracy is feeble and and too divided and incapable of dealing with a problem like this. And we have to make the case that it has the capacity, you know, yes, and it also needs to, it needs good governance and responsible governance. It needs to learn from its mistakes. And that's one of the great strengths of democracy, the power of to self-correct. And as I said recently, you know, I don't think anything that has happened in the world has done more to reverse this dimension, this crisis, than the uprising in Belarus, because it sort of showed here was a country where Lukashenko was, you know, behaving very, very irresponsibly on COVID, as well as being, you know, corrupt and authoritarian and repressive of the culture. And the uprising showed that, you know, people are not giving in. Democracy is resilient. And I think that hopefully they will succeed. I know Putin would like to reverse it, but hopefully they will succeed, and that it will give momentum to the democratic cause at a very difficult moment.
You know, that's really an interesting point that you bring up about, you know, obviously Belarus, a lot of people are watching on what's going on there, largest, you know, crowds ever in, you know, in Lukashenko's dictatorship. You have uprisings in Eastern Russia, for things that are going on there, demanding more democracy, more transparency there. You continue to see people take to the streets in Hong Kong. You've seen this in Mali. You keep on seeing people come to the streets even during, you know, this pandemic, because I think they are just craving for more, you know, responsive government and more democracy, more, you know, more human rights. So it's a really good point to look at Belarus as sort of this case study of what's going on in the world and how a country who handled COVID so terribly, and people are just demanding justice. I want to come back to you for a second. You were the inaugural president, the inaugural leader of NED. So what brought you there? I mean, I know you alluded to it a little bit before, you know, you worked with Jean Kirkpatrick, but, you know, what brought you to NED? Why did you start, and what keeps you committed?
Well, what brought me to Jean? Which is an interesting story. I mean, I'm a product of the 1960s, the civil rights movement. And I guess I didn't start out as an activist, but I became an activist. I went into the VISTA, the Volunteers, the Domestic Peace Corps in 65 to 67. And then I became a very close associate of one of the most important civil rights leaders, Bayard Rustin. He's the one who, today, by the way, is the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington. And Bayard, August 28th, Bayard was the person who organized that march.
Wow.
And I worked for Bayard, not in 63 when he organized the march, but I started working for him in the beginning of 1969 and remained closely associated with him until his death. And he was an extraordinary activist, very much in the tradition of people like, you know, others that we've mentioned, like Jean Kirkpatrick and others. He was a great Democrat. And being active with him, I joined a social democratic movement, which was a little bit on the left, but also strongly anti-communist. And I became a kind of an anti-communist activist. Yep. Defending human rights and democracy in the Soviet Union and in Central Europe, but all over the world. And as the 70s wore on, I started writing for Commentary magazine. And I got to know Jean, and we became friends. So then when she wrote an article in Commentary, I had an article in the same issue. We became friends, and she invited me to come with her when she was appointed by, you know, she was appointed nominated by Reagan to be ambassador to the UN because of that article that she had in commentary, Dictatorships and Double Standards. Mm-hmm. And so she invited me to join her, and I became like her right hand at the UN. So I was well positioned in a way, having been working in a social democratic organization and with close ties to the American labor movement, and then going to work in the Reagan administration for Jean Kirkpatrick. And so the NED then came along. Mm-hmm. Reagan gave the Westminster Address in 1982, and then in 83, the National Endowment for Democracy Act was passed. And so when they were looking around for somebody to run it,
just looking around,
I was there, and it was I was somehow able to do something like that. I was not a bureaucrat. I was not an academic.
Yeah.
I was not a lawyer. I was an activist, and it turned out that this institution that was being created was an institution that was really meant to support activists. Reagan said that in his Westminster Address when he said that there was a democratic revolution taking place in the world. And the idea, he said, was to help them succeed and to help them build their own democracies and the institutions of democracy. And so I came out of a kind of pre-NED period as an activist, as a democracy activist. So then when the NED came along, I was able to then, you know, help try to enable this institution to survive and then grow and to connect. And this is the most important thing, to connect with the movements around the world that were fighting for democracy. And that really only started to grow around the time NED was created. I mean, there weren't loads and loads of these democracy NGOs in the world at that time. But they proliferated. And then you had, obviously, the fundamental changes in South Korea and Philippines in 87 and 86. You had the fall of the Berlin Wall. You had a kind of global revolution that Sam Huntington called the third wave. I mean, Reagan talked about it in 82, and Huntington wrote that book a decade later. But Reagan had really identified the third wave in the Westminster Address. Mm-hmm. And then we were there to try to help those movements along. And then you have what I would call the reverse wave, which has become a more difficult period. But we're there to help people survive the authoritarian resurgence, the democratic backsliding.
So you were a perfect candidate for the job with your activist background and, you know, having worked in this field for a long time. The people that NED supports, you know, they are activists. They are on the ground. They are demanding. So your background was a perfect place.
I was lucky.
We've all been lucky, but I think you've been an architect of this work. And I think so many activists around the world are thankful for what you have helped create. They've made it work. We all have to support and give credit where credit is due. But I know in places like Belarus, and you mentioned Sudan, so many far-flung places where you just don't think that democracy or activism will result in anything, you got to keep the fight going. And I think you believe that, Senator McCain believed that, Madeleine Albright believes it. There's so many people that know that this is a long slog. This isn't just an overnight situation by any means.
You know, last month we held our democracy award. We do it every year in the Congress, but this year we had to do it virtually. And we honored three NGOs from Sudan. And luckily our staff was able to have gone out to Sudan before the COVID lockdown. So they had film and video, and we prepared videos on the three groups. When I watched those videos of these three groups, one was a women's organization, one a youth organization, and one was something called the Darfur Bar Association. But as these people talked about democracy, they were speaking. Let me just turn this off. Excuse me. When they were talking about democracy, they were talking about it in a way that we have almost forgotten to talk about it. They had much more passion and idealism in the way they were talking than we have today with all the cynicism and division in our country. And you know, when the NED was created, there was the term that emerged called democracy promotion, as if we were out there promoting democracy and we were inspiring others to, you know, to have democracy. When actually today, you know, it's my great hope that groups in Sudan or in Belarus or in Hong Kong can remind us of what democracy is all about and why it is so essential and so valuable, that it can never be taken for granted, that it has to constantly be defended. There was an abolitionist before the Civil War, Wendell Phillips, who said that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. We can never give up. I think that was McCain's message too. You can never get complacent. You have to constantly fight for it. And if you don't, you're gonna find yourself in a lot of trouble. And here I was looking at these Sudanese groups and I'm saying, wow, they're inspiring us, which is quite remarkable. You know, that's just an indication of what the crisis is today.
Yeah. I wanted to end, because we're coming up to the end now. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of protests out there. There's a lot of resistance to democracy. You know, there are a lot of threats to democracy. What makes you optimistic about the next 40 years? I know you've talked about, you know, this issue of, you know, the friction between, you know, authoritarianism, democracy, and that's where we are right now. But what gives you hope, you know, for Ned's next 40 years, you know, going forward?
What gives me hope is that I believe that people want freedom and democracy. And that's what Reagan said in the Westminster Address, and I think it's true. Obviously, they also want security. They want, you know, an orderly society, and authoritarians can take advantage of that. Democracy has its vulnerabilities. But people want their dignity to be respected. They want the freedom to live their life, to have their culture, to raise their families, to pursue a business and to pursue their lives. They don't want to be controlled by like China, by a surveillance state that is going to try to control every aspect of people's life. There is this, what you might call, and Reagan called it in the Westminster Address, kind of an instinct for freedom. And that's not going to go away. You know, these authoritarian governments like China or Russia, you mentioned the protests in the Far East and Russia, you know, they what they fear most of all, and this is really why we were sanctioned by China, they fear what they call a color revolution. They fear people protesting, and they want to blame it on outsiders, but it really comes from that instinct for freedom, an instinct for self-respect, for dignity, for human dignity, and wanting to have that, be able to live a life in freedom and not to be controlled by authoritarian forces. And even though there are clearly, you know, enormous challenges and problems and vulnerabilities for liberal democracy, it's very difficult to build a society with the rule of law where people can compromise with each other and tolerate each other when there are very sharp differences, differences that are exploited by demagogues and by authoritarian people and anti-liberal elites, which is happening all over the world today. So it has these real weaknesses and vulnerabilities. But the hope is that with an institution like NED, people can grow. Amartya Sen once said that one of the purposes of democracy has many purposes, a protective purpose, you know, because people can vote and have institutions like human rights institutions that can defend themselves. It has it has many other ways in which it advances democracy. But another one way which is really important is it has a constructive function, that people can grow. If they can practice democracy, they can grow. They can learn from their mistakes. And that is my hope over time, that not only do people have this instinct, but when they get democracy and they're having trouble establishing democracy and having a transition to democracy, they will learn. They will grow as having done that. And this ultimately is why I believe it's important. It has a future. And why institutions like NED that can help people deal with the very, very complex and difficult challenges of consolidating democracy, that will retain a real necessary function in the very difficult and complex world of the future. Social media makes it much, much more difficult. It really has created conditions that people could never have expected when the NED was first created. But people also use social media. I mean, authoritarian regimes use social media to control. Social media can divide people, but it also can be used by people as an instrument to struggle for freedom. And that's what's happening also in the world today. So we always look on the positive side, but I think there's reason to do that.
Well, Carl, thank you so much for joining us today. You've certainly, the last point you made about instinctual, it's an instinct to fight for freedom. That's something that I'm certainly going to take away from this conversation. But we really thank you for joining us. And thank you for all the work that you do, everyone at NED, but also all the people that, that NED supports and that continue to give us all inspiration. So thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks. It's been a great experience for me too. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This podcast is produced by Patrick McCann and Justin Kessler. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, tell your friends, or leave a review.